All right, well, welcome back, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the few hours of dry weather we had over the weekend. I think it rained every single day since the beginning of the semester, so. Let's see. Joseph just told me that his Thursday section is under enroll. So if you're like, think you're on the waiting list and or interested in changing, you might want to check out Thursday. Thursday is good. Check out Thursday. All right. Last time. Yeah, any questions on that? No. Yeah. Is it all hours? The sections which? 11 to 1. 11 to 1. Yeah. So Thursday, 11 to 1 has quite a bit of available spots. Okay. This is something that I'll do is I'll quickly review kind of the material at the beginning of every lecture. And this is a good kind of learning tip as well. When you have like, you know, outlines like this, it doesn't really tell you much of anything. But these are like little primers so that when you look at this slide, you can say, okay, scientific method, what do I know about the scientific method? And you can think back for a moment what we talked about. And the first thing we talked about was defining things that you needed to do science. And I gave you three requirements for the scientific study, and it was starts with O, order. Okay, so it needs the order in the world, and then with D, determinism, and then again with O, observability. Okay, so those are the kind of three things that you need to be able to do science. And then we talked a little bit about what contribution of Karl Popper was, who is a philosopher who kind of defined the scientific method. And his big contribution has to do with observability, which is to kind of separate things which are part of the scientific realm and things which are not. And so demarcation was basically making a line between things which we can study scientifically and other things which are part of the human experience and which we have not yet, let's say, being able to study scientifically. Okay? All right. So that's one thing. His other big contribution was to kind of separate in the scientific process the theoretical part from the empirical part. The empirical part is where you get data, you analyze the data, you make some inference based on your data. The theoretical part is where you use logic to kind of explain the world. Okay? And it's very important to keep in mind that there's these two parts in science, right? You can't just do empirical work. Well, you need to have both contributions. You could be a scientist who's mostly empirical and a scientist who's mostly theoretical. But for the progress of science, you need these two things. And bad science is often a science which has problems with its empirical, you know, with its empirical part, the way it analyzes the data, but really usually lacks any kind of theoretical foundation. And that's kind of a good marker of bad science. So, right. So don't, you know, underestimate the importance of a theory in science because it's key. That's kind of one of the conclusions there. Okay, and then we talked mostly about empirical research, which is really the focus of this whole class, and divided into two types of research, observational and experimental. Experimental is where the experimenter controls the conditions, right? And observational is where you just go out and observe the world and make some inferences based on your observations. And we kind of made a list here of different type of observational studies, survey studies, natural observation, you know, like field work, and then just correlational studies where you just go out there and just get some measures and make some correlations of one measure over the other. Okay. So today we're going to dive into really statistics. And this course is really a stats course. And I just gave you kind of two quick classes, one and a half really, two lectures on research methods. And from time to time we'll come back to research methods and talk about, you know, how do we make a good experiment and what defines a good experiment. But most of the time we're going to be doing stats. And the topic for today is really histograms. And it's also the thing that you're going to be doing in lab both this week and next week. before we go to our main topic today, there's a few kind of definitions. And at this point, these will seem a little dry. And you'll see as we go through the class, they'll make more and more sense. But stats are divided into kind of two big branches. The first one is called descriptive statistics, and the second one is called inferential statistics. And again, you know, you can use your knowledge of the English language to kind of figure out what these two branches are. Descriptive statistics is where you actually look at your data and you kind of quantify your data. You're looking at all your data and you're kind of describing it, right? You're saying, okay, you know, the mean of the height is so much, it has this much spread, it has, you know, the distribution has this shape. You're really kind of using descriptors to kind of analyze your data. Inferential statistics is where you're making inferences. So inferences and conclusions are kind of the same thing. Here you're testing hypotheses. You're saying, for example, are women in the class smaller in size, shorter than the men in the class? Okay, that could be a hypothesis. You can then analyze the data and then from the data see if you can draw that conclusion. Okay, straightforward. Okay, so descriptive statistics, we're doing that for this week and next week. And the first step, this is always a good idea actually, is to look at all your raw data. Okay, you're gonna go out there, you're gonna get a bunch of data, you wanna be able to look at all of it. And it's not very helpful to have pages and pages of like, you know, table data. So we need to kind of summarize all this raw data and have good ways to visualize our data. Okay. So, right. So let me just, before we go into the visualization, a few more definitions for variables. And this, you know, it's kind of confusing, and then it becomes natural as you use them. But let me go through it now. And as I say again, it's dry. I realize this. But as we're going to use it more and more, this is going to become more natural and more relevant to you. So the first one is the difference between an independent variable and a dependent variable. And this really only makes sense in the context of experimental design. So let's see here. And the reason for this is that the independent variable is what is under the control of the experimenter, right? And the dependent variable is then what is measured, the outcome. So an independent variable might be, for example, whether or not you're taking the placebo or the actual drug, and your dependent variable would be the rate of cancer. Okay? It's what is dependent on the different situations from your experiments. All right. You will see that people misuse this, and sometimes they have correlational studies, and they will use independent and dependent variables to really mean kind of cause and effect, you know, like, you know, X causes Y, right? The independent variable causes the dependent variable, even when you're doing an observational study. And so that's really not correct to do. We'll talk about that more later on. Okay. Now, there's different types of variables. And they can be classified under three big groups, which is nominal, ordinal, and scale. So nominal, as it says, are names, labels. Okay, it's when you actually go out and label the data. For example, you could say man and woman. Okay, two different labels, smoker, non-smoker, even, you know, placebo, not placebo. All those things are basically kind of groups that, or, you know, it's a variable that where you use a name. An ordinal is now a number, so this is a character. The ordinal is now a number, but where you have a rank, okay? So an ordinal variable would be birth order, whether you're first born, second born, third born, etc. That would be an example of an ordinal. Another example of ordinal would be your rank in a test. Got the top, the best score, the second best score, etc. Okay, so things are in rank. This is the one that we're going to use the most, which is scale, which is, again, a number, but it doesn't have this order necessarily, right? And so everything else that you can think of, for example, the height, you know, the number of times you fell in love, your happiness index, any kind of index you come up with, you know, any kind of scale from 0 to 7 becomes the scale variable. Okay. The scale variables are divided into two subgroups, which is the interval and the ratio. An interval scale, a good example of this is degrees Fahrenheit. An interval scale is defined by its interval, meaning that the difference between 50 degrees Fahrenheit and 60 degrees Fahrenheit, in terms of the difference in temperature, is the same as between 80 degrees Fahrenheit and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Right? There's an interval there of 10 degrees, and it doesn't matter where you are on the scale, it measures that interval. Okay? All right. And most of the variables that we're going to be using are going to be interval scales. The difference between an interval scale and a ratio scale is that this one has a real zero. And the example of these in degrees is degrees Kelvin. So when you have something that has a real zero, not only are intervals correct, but are ratios correct. Okay? So if you go from 1 degree Kelvin to 10 degree Kelvin, that's a factor of 10 more energy. If you go from 10 degree Kelvin to 100 degree Kelvin, is a factor, again, of 10 times more energy. So these ratios are preserved. And to have this, you need to have a real zero. Okay? You need to have an absolute zero. All right. An example that's maybe less has to do with physics. Well, can anybody give me another example of a ratio scale? Height, very good. Right, height is very good. So height has an absolute zero, and then you measure it from there. Height is a good one. Anything else? So again? Weight, height, weight. Yeah, all these things which are really kind of, you know, have good physical, are solely, you know, have a strong physical relationship with something that you can measure in the real world might have an absolute zero. How about examples that are more to do with psychology? What can you think of anything in psychological research where you might have an absolute zero? I'm going to give you one. Interval between manic episodes. So if I measure this in days, let's say, zero means something, two means something, three means something, right? And you know, six is an interval that's twice as long as three, right? And so this ratio holds because I have an absolute zero. All right. So why do we care that we have these two things? And you can put a little note here, because it's only going to come up once in the rest of the class. But it does matter for statistical measures. There's something that's called the coefficient of variance. I'm going to just call it CV. So coefficient of variance. This you can only calculate for ratio variables. Don't worry about it right now. Just put this little note down here. 3 weeks from now, we're going to talk about the CV, and you'll understand what it is, and you'll see what it makes sense. But it's just so that this is not, you know, definitions that fall into kind of empty background. Okay. Any questions on this? Yeah. Psychological interval, yeah, sure. So an interval, actually, most of the scales that you pull out, you know, and you say, okay, give me a rank, you know, between, you know, 0 and 10 of something, will actually be an interval scale. Okay, and so if I, for example, the happiness index that I came out, people don't really, you know, you can't really quite say 0 is this kind of absolute thing. So if you just let people subjectively give you a scale like that, they will use an interval scale. So most things that we're going to be using are going to be interval scales. Okay. We're good? Any other questions?
Good. All right.
All right. So let's dive into histograms. all right. So what we're going to do is, again, I have things here which are, sorry, I'm backing up a little bit, which are bold and things which are italic, right? Like this histogram probability distribution. So these are things that you're supposed to know what they are, okay? And so you might get a definition of what is a sample, what is the population, and so forth. So if you see this, just listen to the lecture notes or look at your Black Lightning notes and see what they are. So so we've talked already about the difference between the sample and the population. The population, right, is the largest possible group of people that your hypothesis refers to. Okay, so that's the population that you're studying. But usually, you're not going to test the entire population. You're going to test a subset of the population, and that's your sample. So the sample is the one where you're going to collect the data and do your statistical analysis. So we're going to get some data from a sample, and we want to be able to visualize that. And so we're going to do what's called a histogram of our data. And this tells us a little bit about the probability distribution of this variable for the population. All right. So these are the topics that we're going to cover right here. So we're going to talk about how to calculate a frequency and relative frequency histogram from data. Then we're going to say, okay, now if we have continuous scale variables, how do we do a histogram? And we're going to have to define groups or bin sizes. So that's going to be another little topic. And then the last little topic is we're going to talk a little bit about the size of this bin size that we use to estimate histograms. So those are the three things that I'll be covering in the next couple of lectures. Okay, so this is just to give you an example now of what a histogram looks like. This would be the probability of the height for the population of U.S. psychology majors. So this is kind of the entire population, and there's about 20,000 U.S. Psychology majors, and if you look at their distribution, it's going to look something like this, right? I have a lot of data here, and what I can read on the y-axis here is what is the probability of, you know, having a height between 60 and 61 inches, okay, which is given me by the height of this bar. And this is the sample. So this is actually, I took this from the height from the data from spring 04, but in a minute we'll do it for our class. And you can see that it's a little bit more noisy, but this is the distribution of heights for our, you know, the class a couple years ago. And this is supposed to give you a picture of this, right? Because this is what we have, and you can see it's pretty good, right? It gives you kind of the same idea in terms of where the average is and where the spread is, but it's a little bit more noisy. Okay, so let's just take it step by step, and you know, how do we do histograms? And let's say that I got happiness scores, and there they are at the top. And what I want to do with a histogram is I want to figure out what is the probability of getting 5, getting 6, getting 7, and so forth. So the first thing I'm going to do is count how many times, you know, one of you said 5, how many times one of you said 6. And so I'm going to write here all the possible values of happiness. I think this is pretty obvious. So there we go. Those are all the possible values we have. And then I'm going to count how many times I had 1 and how many times we had 1. Zero. How many times we had two? Zero. How many times we had three? We had one, three. How many times we had four? All right. Five. Count. We have two, five. How many sixes? One, two, three, four, five. How many sevens? One, two, three, four. How many eights? One, two. How many nines? None. And how many tens? One. Okay. So there we are. So I just put the count, right? This is, I call this the count, or the frequency of all the possible values. And this is going to be called the frequency table. No, the whole thing. The whole thing is called a frequency table, where I have all the possible values of my variable here, happiness score, and the frequency, meaning how many times I found it, the count of that. Now, what do I need to do? So this is count or frequency. I mean, it's the same thing. So what do I need to do to get probability? What is the probability of, for example, that the happiness score was 6? We're dividing by what? By the sample size, by the number that we have, right? So we see how many scores we had, so I'm just going to count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. And I'm going to write low n, that's my sample size. And that's just going to be equal to 15. So to go from here to there, what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide by 15. Divide by 15. And so that's going to be 0, 0, 1 over 15, 0, 2 over 15, 5 over 15, 4 over 15, 2 over 15, 0, 1 over 15. Okay, and now this is what's called the relative frequency or the probability, right here. So I'll just write down relative frequency. Oops. Or probability. Okay. And so what I can do now, this is the table, my frequency table. What I can do now is plot it. And so on the x-axis, I'm going to put all the possible values. And on the y-axis, I'm going to either put the count or the frequency or the relative frequency. Okay? So again, the x-axis, just to go slowly, right, we'll have values of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then on the y value, I'm going to do a bar graph. And so, for example, 3 is going to be 1, and then 5 is going to be 2. And then 6 is going to be 5, etc. This is 1, this is 2, and this is 5. Okay? So, etc., right? I haven't finished my histogram, but this is how I'll be making my histogram. So here it is with this data. For a real data set of 101 answers, and I just counted how many answers there were in all these different groups, and here is the relative frequency or the probability, and I can then display this in terms of happiness index for the class. All right, so are there any questions on this? And so you've seen it. I've done it two ways here. One of them I put count, which is just the number. Now on the y-axis, the number of times, the number of answers that was 4, the number of answers that were 5. And I can also put, instead of count, percent, right, which is what is the percent of time that you answer 4. which is just the number divided by the sample size. And that's these numbers, right? So, you know, somewhere around 5% of the people had a happiness of 4, and, you know, about 6 or 7% had a happiness index of 7. Okay? Good? And any questions on this? Right. Oh, yeah. I should be more consistent. It doesn't matter. Let's put the small n for sample size. It's more standard. Okay. So, let's see. So what we can do now is, because you might be interested in your own. So here's R, and you guys are going to be doing this next week. This week you're just going to like make sure you can start it. But here we have R Commander, and I'll enter the class data so we can view our data set. Oops. Let's see, where is it? So here it is. So this is your data that you're going to be using to do a lot of the lab. So the GSIs were nice enough to enter all that little things that you put in a little piece of paper. And you can see there's obviously no identity here in terms of these data points. But then what I can do is I can go under graphs, and I can select a histogram, and let's do the happiness. And see, it's asking me here whether I want frequency, counts, percentage, which is the same thing as probability, or densities. Densities is a little complicated. We'll cover it on Wednesday and on Friday, but we'll get to it as well because it's important. So let's just do, let's do percentage. And then I just click OK. And where is it? Oh, here it is. Okay. And here it is for the class. So you can see a lot of you guys are at 7. That's going to be the mode. So about 40% of the class has a happiness of 7. And then there's some very happy people and then some not so happy people in the class. All right. So any questions on this? We're good? So, okay, so then we can start talking about the next topic, which is what happens if, instead of using something like a happiness index, where I expect you guys answered either 6 or 7, I don't think you did 7.32137, you know, whatever, right? You didn't use decimal points to define your happiness index. But what happens if you actually do have something where you're actually doing a measure? For example, you could say, you know, time, reaction time. You know, reaction time as some task, and you measure things in milliseconds. If you do that, every single person will have a different value, right? You can imagine a situation where, you know, my reaction time to a task might be, you know, 315 milliseconds, and yours might be 215 milliseconds, somebody else, you know, 318 milliseconds. Every single one has a slightly different value because it's kind of continuous variable that we measured with high precision. Okay? If I just did this thing, well, how many people said 317? It'd be what? It'd be one. Okay. And so it'd be one for every single possible answer. So if I actually went and used the same method to do a histogram, I would get, you know, a flat bar at one, right? There'd be a lot of zeros, and then from time to time, you would get one. So what we need to do is group the data and say, okay, how many people had reaction times between 310 milliseconds and 320 milliseconds? So I define kind of an interval, and I put everybody in that same interval. Whether you're 313, 314, or 318, you're going to be lumped together in the 310 to 320 interval. Okay? So this is the example for height. and just imagine that instead of you kind of giving me the height, I'd actually measure your height, you know, with a very fancy instrument, and had your height in inches with you know, many degrees of precision. What I would do then is I would say, okay, I'm going to look at everybody who is in the interval between 64 and 65 inches, or 65 and 66 inches, or 66 and 67 inches. So I have to say, I have to now define kind of the boundaries, not just one value, but the lower boundary and the upper boundary of the interval. And there's a few kind of things that, you know, you want to be systematic about it. See, you can see that 65 is on both. So if you say 65, do I go into this bin or that bin? Well, you have to be systematic, right? So you can say, okay, this is equal to 64 all the way to 65, but not 65, right? And this starts at exactly at 65, it goes all the way to 66, but not 66. So I don't count you twice or forget to count you, okay? So you just define your bins in this kind of very systematic way. So this could be, you know, this could be, you know, my height should be greater or equal than 64 inches, but absolutely less than 65 inches. And this would be for all the people whose height is greater or equal to 65 inches, but absolutely less than 66 inches. Something like this, right? So that you don't count people twice. Yeah. Well, that's the same thing. So this basically says 64.9999, right? But yeah. Yes. Right. Right. So somebody might write 64.99999 here. Okay. Okay. So once you've defined your bins, you can then just do the same thing. I'm just counting everybody who has a height which is between 64 and 65. And in this, for this class, this is not your class, but from previous years, we had 12 people here, 13 people there, 10 people there. And I might do the same thing to get actually the probability. I just have to divide by the sample size, which is 106 here. So let me use low n to be consistent. So to go from there to there, I just divide by sample size, right? Divided by n to get that value. All right. So now, once I do that, I get a nice little histogram of something which, on this axis right here, is a continuous variable. Okay? You can take on any possible value on this axis. Yeah?
So, what is your definition for a bin?
The definition for a bin is the same thing as an interval. It's two terms to say the same thing. So a bin and interval mean the same thing. It means that you have two edges, right? And so the bin is kind of like, you imagine, you know, putting all the data in this bin, basically. And it's defined as an interval between, you know, something and something. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. So here's our histogram for the height, and now we're going to go to another topic, which is, why did we choose to have an interval size or a bin width, same thing, of 1 inch, right? I just did it 1 inch. We could also done it in terms of 2 inches, right? So what I could have done here is to say, okay, I'm going to use, right, so this is the height greater or equal to 64 and less than 66. And that's the same thing as my interval size. So my interval size or my bin width, instead of being 1 inch, can be 2 inches. And then if I give you the 1 inch data, one bin width inch data, right, between 64 and 66, I just have 12 plus 13 points. I would have 25 points here, right? So it's going to change a little bit what I'm plotting. So this is just 12 plus 13. And the probability is also actually just the sum of these two probabilities. Okay? So I'm actually showing you something different. I'm going to show you what's the probability of finding somebody in the class whose height is between 64 and 66 inches. Obviously, that's going to be a little bigger than the probability that somebody is between 64 and 65, or 65 and 66. Right? Yeah. No. A continuous scale is, scale variable is when you don't have kind of discrete values for it, right? So if I say, if you use something like happiness index, I'm expecting you to say something that's really an integer, 0 or 1 or 2. I'm not expecting you to say 3.567. But if I measure your height or if I measure your reaction time, I have them a continuous value, where I have data now that comes in with a lot of precision, right? And then I need to kind of lump it together. Okay. And so here we have our next issue then is, how do we choose the correct bin width, right? And so here is the population, and then here is the histograms that I get for my sample, and you can see that I can do 0.5 inches, and then I get something that's quite noisy. I can do something which is 1 inch, and I get something that's like that, and then I can get a 2-inch interval, and I get a picture like this, histogram like that, what do you think? If this is supposed to be kind of a picture of the population, which one of these would you like better? 2 inches? Yeah, I think so too. I think 2 inches actually gives you a good kind of picture of what goes on. So there actually are methods to figure out what is kind of this optimal bin width, but what you're going to be doing in this class is you're going to have to decide effectively how many, what is the size of your bin width, and kind of play with it to display your data. So if you do something, if you have a continuous variable and you use one that's where your bin size is too small, you're going to get something that's very noisy, all right? Each one of this was probably one person, right? So this is just one data point that shows up here many times. And so you might want to play with the size of your bin widths to get something which is smooth and is kind of representative of what you're trying to show, all right? Okay. So, I think the next slide has some kind of choosing the bin width. So, the larger the sample size, it's kind of, I think, intuitive. The smaller the optimal bin width is. So, if you have a lot of data, you're going to be able to, like, for each one of these little bins, even if they're small, you're going to have a lot of people there. So, you're going to be able to get a good estimate of what that bin is. But you have a small sample size, you might want to increase your bin width. And then the less variability in the data, again, the smaller the optimal bin size. Okay. Are there any questions on bin widths? You could see it's arbitrary, right? You get to choose what it is. You don't want to make it so small that what you're describing is not really useful in some ways, right? I mean, if you're just showing again every single data point on the line, that's not very useful. You want to get an idea of the shape of the distribution. But if you make it too big, you can actually also over-smooth things. All right, I'm gonna keep on going, you guys. I'm gonna take a little pause to ask if you have any questions, and then I'm gonna keep on doing the next lecture because that will, I'm usually kind of don't get to finish the material, so if I can go a little farther, I can actually cover what we're supposed to cover. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So, good point. All right, so... So I have two things here. The larger the sample size, the smaller the optimal bin width. The less variability in the data, the smaller optimal bin width. What I mean by this, variability is something that, that is kind of relative. But let's say that, right, instead of doing the height of the Psych 101, you're doing the height of, you know, I don't know, what would be something that's very heterogeneous? I don't know if NBA basketball players all have the same height. They probably have quite a bit. But let's say NBA basketball players, and let's say that they're all seven foot, right? Because they're all very tall. And so what you might want to do there then is the bin width for a group that's very heterogeneous could actually be a lot smaller. You're going to have enough data to really tell the difference between, you know, a 7 foot, 7'1", and 6'11", in terms of data. So you can make your bin size smaller because everybody tends to fall in the same areas, right? So it's something that's, it's kind of a relative thing, but that's what I mean. So, okay. Did that answer your question? All right. So, well, let's see. Are there any other questions on the material so far? You guys were all able to download R? No. So it seems to me, I'm not going to go into the next one, but we're going to help you during session. But if you have a Mac, you need to install X11 on your Mac before you have R. Okay. And so if you follow the instructions, I think it tells you about where to find X11. It should be, it's either on your computer or it's on your disk, but wasn't installed on your computer. Or you can actually download it from a website, okay? And then once you have X11, you want to actually start X11 before you start R Commander. And I think the instructions tell you to do it the other way. But if you start R Commander, it has a little icon where you click and you start X11. Instead of doing that, start X11 and then start R Commander. Yeah. Yeah, your GSIs will help you during sections. You know, they might have a hard, you know, they're not experts at, you know, operating systems either. So it's something, but they're going to, you know, try to debug it with you. So, yeah. So bring your Mac and bring your computers at session and see if we can figure it out. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. No. So the way the lab works is, it's posted, you know, I post it on Friday night. You print it sometime during the weekend. You read it so that if you have any questions, you can ask your GSI. And then you start it in lab session. And you try to finish it in lab session. You work hard to try to finish it in lab session. If you can't finish in lab session, you take it with you home. You finish it at home and bring it before the beginning of the next lab session. Beginning of session the following week. Yeah.